three times we've looked into the Song of Solomon and have seen that it is most likely a play, certainly a song that was intended for public presentation. And tonight we're going to be looking at a very lengthy section of it, so I might be in a little bit of a hurry this evening. But please do open to Song of Solomon. We'll be starting off in chapter 3. On the screen, I have another one of these aerial shots of the city of Jerusalem. Thought I would string a couple of these together because I know, just for instance, it's kind of hard to see in the back of the building anyway, and so I've given several of these over several lessons. So you just get the general lay of the land, and once again, we are looking north, this time standing just a little bit further to the west, as this area here is the Mount of Olives, and this is our famous Mount Zion, the Temple Mount itself, probably down in this region right here is where Jesus would have had the Jewish trials, probably over in this area right here is where the Roman trials would have taken place, and somewhere in this region was a house 3,000 years ago that it took 13 years to build with thousands of skilled laborers working on it. Back in those days, 3,000 years ago, somewhere in this general area stood a house that was magnificent beyond all compare. In that house, as one artist has depicted it, you had a throne which had lions, 12 of them, that were arranged, you know, just for impression's sake, as you approach that throne. And then you would have the best, most expensive, highest quality structure that probably graced the earth at that time. Solomon being so immensely wealthy, so incomparably wise, and with the blessing of God, of peace in his nation at that time, free then, you know, to build such a structure. Tonight, in the Song of Solomon, we're going to be reading something about the wealth, about the very beautiful manner in which this man was able to present himself before the world. So we have been looking, as I've said, at what I hope is best understood, I think is properly understood, as a play or sort of a, what's the word I'm looking for, you know, lengthy song that would have been presented publicly. And I've suggested that it has a title, first off, just one verse there, and then a total of seven scenes. There is a harem scene in which this young woman is being prepared for her marriage to the king. There is a courtship scene, which we finished last week. There are five verses dedicated to her dream, which we'll be taking up in the first five verses of chapter 3 in just a moment. And then there is a wedding that begins at chapter 3 and verse 6 and was read as the opening scripture here this evening, but does not conclude until chapter 5 and verse 1. So we read only six verses, I guess it was. And then we have all of chapter 4 that's a part of that as well. Then that will be followed by a nightmare scene before and after the wedding. We have a dream, one positive, one negative. And then the old age love of this couple who have now from their youth throughout all of their lives, as depicted in this play, have come to those mature years, still very much in love, and closing out at the very end of those years and looking back on the life that they have had. So those of you that may not have seen this chart, it was 2 weeks ago. I didn't put it up last week. This is my suggestion, and not one that I've created myself, one I found in a commentary many years ago. It seems to me the most likely best way to understand what the book is about. I've suggested that it is not some sort of an allegory or parable of the relationship between Jesus and the church. I think it's not that at all. It was intended on its surface to be understood of the love of human beings while they are upon this earth. And also do not think that Solomon is the bad guy who, with scandalously ulterior motives, is seeking to subvert the love of some innocent young woman so that he can win her away from a shepherd boy. I think Solomon is the shepherd that we read about here in these verses, that he is very worthy of praise and honor. He's upright and dignified in the way that he treats her. But, and we'll begin to see this especially here this evening, it is a culture of 3,000 years ago. It is also a culture that is very Eastern, while we are very Western. It is both a time and a group of people that had different customs, different ways of going about things, and who were apparently somewhat more frank in polite society, in public, polite and dignified public, you know, about the marital relationship than we are today. And so it's not to say that we are wrong and they are right. It's not to say vice versa. It is only to say that if you've done much world traveling, and how many of you have? How many of you have traveled outside the United States of America? I don't mean Canada. This is too similar. You know, if you go, as Jerry and I have, to the Philippines, if you go to countries that are not very Western in their influence, you're going to find that the way they view the world, the things that they consider to be appropriate, very, very different than ours. And again, that's not necessarily to say the American way, truth, justice, and the American way, is the only way at all. I can't fault the song in any way. But let's go ahead now and start with chapter 3. If you're making notes in your Bibles there, I'm calling this the dream scene. It encompasses the first 5 verses of chapter 3. And the first 4 of those verses is this young bride-to-be. So apparently a solo now is being sung. She is, the chief player there, the female lead. And she says, "On my bed, night after night, I sought him." Well, how can you seek anybody lying in bed? Okay? Obviously, he's not going anywhere. It must be, then, in her thoughts, whether conscious as she falls asleep or in a dream scene, as I suggested. She says, "On my bed night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me and said, 'Have you seen him whom my,' I said, 'Have you seen him whom my soul loves?' Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me." Now, when you look at those words, you have to wrestle with those words. Is this not a song, no poetic license, not a play, the actual record of a historical event? Every night, this poor woman never left her bed and went all through the city. Or started off in her bed and then actually got out of the bed and went through the city asking everybody, "Where's my love? Where's my love?" And then she finds it. Oh, and I'm so glad. Okay? What? That's kind of weird, to try and put this into actual physical terms. And so what I'm suggesting, having read, from others, is that as this play is being presented, and as we often do in our movies and plays today, there would have been some sort of indication, scene change. And what this is designed to do is to be a solo part that, in a very beautiful manner, is just saying, "I am obsessed with the one that I love. I think about him all the time. I think about him in my dreams. I'm not happy if I'm not around him. And anytime I'm not around him, all I can think about is trying to find him. And when I find him, then I'm satisfied, I'm happy, and I can rejoice." Now, you maybe have noticed this, though it is hard, I know, week to week, whole week in between, to take note. But see verse 5 and how it is not the first time that we've seen that. And that apparently it is now Solomon who sings in response to her desperate seeking him. He says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem." Who were they? The chorus in the play. The daughters of Jerusalem is a group of women who are singing periodically throughout and helping kind of stitch things together in the play as well. "I adjure you," he says, "O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. Well, looking at verse 1, then looking at verse 5, and is thinking, you know, how can verses 2 and 3 and 4 be possible? Then you realize, well, I can see how this will work if she is depicted as singing in a dream. And now Solomon is saying, don't wake her up. It is a happy and peaceful sleep. And so we have had the harem scene, a courtship scene. They've now met, spent some time together. Now we have this dream scene as she is just revealing, I'm swept off my feet, I love him, I just can't stop thinking about him, I only want to be with him at all times, okay? And then Solomon kind of, you know, overseeing everything, if you will, singing, just let her sleep. The time will come, okay? And now, as you see again, chapter 3, verse 6 through 5, 1, the time comes. Now, we read these verses a moment ago. Let's do it again. It is the scene of the wedding itself on this day. What is this coming up from the wilderness? So it all had been staged outside of town for a grand parade entrance. Like columns of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant. Now just stop right there. This is apparently a wedding parade. It is huge. It is extremely expensive. It is magnificent in its presentation. And the very first verse that you get is, what is this? And what it is something that involves columns of smoke that are apparently themselves incense. It's not a battle, it's not a war, it's not for heat, but there are whole columns of smoke rising that are all incense. The whole city is infused with this aroma now. And you have all of this uproar, you know, something is approaching, and already look in the distance, you can tell that this thing is coming. And so in verse 6, again, like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant. Who is this? 7, behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon. 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. Now, whether or not then this was a wedding scene, you know, in the evening, I'm not sure. But who are these guys? You will read about these men back in the Old Testament. And from early on, in the days of David and following, these kings had special forces, you know, great parades. And these men are named. And something of their training and requirements in order to get into these various groups. And the 60 was one of these groups. These men are the best warriors. They are the personal guard. They are the highest level then of the display of the power of this king. You don't mess with Solomon. He is always protected by these special forces, you know, commando types. Now, when you have military weddings to this day, brethren, what is it usually, you've got this scene in your head, I'm sure, what do you see at the end of the wedding? Wedding over, they're you know, they leave the church building or whatever it is, what do you have that they pass through and under? Okay, you got all these guys in uniform, they got their swords up there, it's the same thing. It's that very same thing. We are having a wedding for a king. We want the king's wisdom, wealth, power, and especially military power to be on display. And so these 60 men are surrounding this traveling couch of Solomon, the mighty men of Israel, fearless wielders of the sword, expert in war. Verse 9, King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. If you're following along, according to the sheet that I handed out 2 weeks ago, and identifying the parts, then the first four verses of chapter 3 is the bride, the fifth verse is Solomon, and verses 6 through 11, to the end of chapter 3, is the chorus. It's the daughters of Jerusalem. So you're going back and forth between a female lead and a male lead, and then this grand chorus. And of course, if you're going to have the wedding parade for the King of Solomon, then who would you expect to be singing? It's grand. It just has to be a lot of voices. And so all the chorus now, you know, swells, and we have some sort of an entry scene now for this traveling couch. Now, by the way, think about how it's described. The timbers of Lebanon, cedar, heavy or light? Silver and gold, heavy or light? See, you can imagine that there are a lot of men, and these are men carrying a very heavy traveling couch, the sedan couch, for the wealthiest guy on the planet at this time on a wedding day. Which brings us to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 15. It's very long. In fact, I've got to look here very quickly because I think it is, in fact, the longest single song in the whole book. This is the Song of Solomon. So guess who's singing? All of these verses come from that male lead, which is, as you know, you have the traveling show throughout Israel, you know, various actors, I suppose, but originally it is Solomon depicting himself. Whether or not Solomon himself would have appeared in this, you know, is anybody's guess, but it is his song at least. He is the author. So now he's going to sing about his love for this young woman. Verse 1. Chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. You know, I always have to stop here. Your hair is like a flock of goats. We bought the house that we're living in right now. We had a little yard shed out there made out of tin that was only 5 feet tall. It was driving me crazy. Things, you know, kind of haven't seen its last legs anyway. But, you know, every time I go in there, I felt like a gorilla. It's only 5 feet tall, I guess. So I put it up on Craigslist and free for anybody to just come and take it away. The wooden floor underneath it had rotted completely out. So it was like paper. You just tear it with your hand. You know, I think it was pretty sad shape there. And then this couple came out yesterday and announced that they had a little farm out there out beyond Barger somewhere, and they wanted to use it as a shelter for goats. Now, Don and I had a couple of goats when the kids were little. We had about 2.5 acres, you know, for most of our lives, the longest place we've lived. And you know, kids growing up, we had a couple of goats. Did we ever look at those goats and think, wow, they are really beautiful? Things might be said about goats, but, you know, unless you're 4-H or something like that, and you spend a long time with a curry comb, usually we don't think, you know, that's very beautiful. Now, it is described here, as he speaks of her beauty, that her what is like a flock of goats? Her hair. But look at the next line. That have descended from Mount Gilead. A flock of goats descended from Mount Gilead. What I suppose, brethren, this is about the picture of standing at a distance and watching a flock of goats as they descend Mount Gilead. So if they have descended Mount Gilead, what would they be doing as you look at the hillside? See, there would be this flowing motion as they're working their way down this hill. And that is a beautiful picture. And it's not the goat hair itself. It's the flock that descended Gilead. that flock. Okay? So he is saying, your hair, it is long, it is beautiful, it is flowing, you know, it takes my breath away. Now, it gets real personal here. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes, which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them is lost or young. See, teeth?
What?
Okay. So, brethren, again, these are cultural differences. Now, today, how many of us hold our flocks to be of just immense value to us? And in them, we've invested a tremendous amount of money. And from them, we make a lot of money. Okay? Those animals are beautiful to us. And we are trying to keep them healthy. We are trying to keep them in a state that makes them more valuable. So, then we also are looking for what? One generation and they all die. You know, how many ranches or farms are going to survive if you have a flock, you raise it up for sale, and then you sell every one of them and you never have any more? No. They each in the picture have what? Twins. Okay? It is a way for this king to say, you are beautiful to me. And I'm going to use all of my wealth as a way of describing it. You are beautiful to me is also a way of saying you are valuable to me. I treasure you. If a man says to a woman, you are my jewel, what is he saying? He's trying to say, you mean so much to me. And again, in this kind of a culture, and in those days then, that's quite a compliment for her teeth. And now in verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like a slice of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones, on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Now, Solomon poetically is describing each of her physical features in a manner that is altogether dignified and respectful and acceptable in their culture. And he is just saying, everything that I have ever held to be beautiful to the eyes, valuable to me, in any sense, any commodity or livestock or whatever, you know, that's ever been valuable to me, I'm going to use them as comparisons to say, you are, to me, as valuable, now fill in the blank, you are as valuable to me as my kingdom. You're as valuable to me as everything I own. You are to me as precious as everything that I have in this vast land and all my possessions. I just want to set you above everything that has been truly precious to me in any category, area, type, or kind. Okay? And it would be well received by this young lady. Wow, thank you. That's quite a compliment. I've always thought my teeth were pretty good, but the way you've described them is quite the compliment. Okay, now comes verse 7. Solomon continues singing, 15 verses of the lead character singing. Verse 7, you are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no blemish in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down from the summit of Amana, from the summit of Senir and Hermon. Now he's naming mountains, brethren, that are, including Hermon to the north, which is over 9,000 feet high. Hermon is the biggest mountain on that whole eastern coast of the Mediterranean there, you know, in that entire region, the tallest thing there is. And then he adds, from Senir and Hermon, in the middle of verse 8 there, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards, You have made my heart beat faster, and here comes a new theme, my sister, my bride. See, you are part of my nation, so you're my sister in the sense that you're a Jew. Now you're my bride. Verse 9, you've made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices. At verse, I lost it here. Where'd it go? Where did it go? Oh, come on, I had it. Oh, there it is, verse 6. At the end of verse 6, where was he going to go? To a mountain of myrrh and a hill of frankincense. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. You know, these are very precious commodities. He's made millions because of these things. He's got mountains of these things. And he is then speaking of physical mountains, Lebanon, Amana, Senir, and Hermon. He speaks of the dens of lions and leopards because living in these regions, they had those things, and there was danger involved in acquiring these commodities. Your heart, verse 9 rather, you make my heart beat faster with a single glance. How beautiful you are, verse 10, much better your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils and all kinds of spices. This entire segment is a continuation of Solomon pointing out his immense and glorious wealth and saying, you were born. Never did it. Come with me and survey it all. From one end of the kingdom to the other, from the lowest point to the highest point, you are beautiful to me beyond all these things and valuable beyond the dangers involved in acquiring them. Verse 11, your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon, which gives a reference to the smell of the cedar there, famous word cedar. 12, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. A rock garden locked, a spring sealed up. Now, what's this about locked and sealed up? It's the wedding day. He's making a big show now in front of everybody. We have our vows, and then he's doing this. You know how precious you are. But what has he just said there, brethren, that is immensely important, I think, you know, for us to appreciate, that sometimes this song has sexual references that are, you know, make us uncomfortable. But what did he say in that verse? She is separated from him. She is a locked garden. She is a sealed garden. In other words, we have not misbehaved. I have longed for this wedding day. We are now going to get married, and you will no longer be a locked garden that is kept apart from me. We will now have the right and opportunity to engage in those activities that have been locked away from us. There is nothing wrong with the relationship that they have had. And he's just like any husband, groom, let me say, you know, on his wedding day, so happy that the courtship, the time is over, the time for the marriage itself that has come. Which brings us now to verse 13. Your shoots, garden locked, rock garden locked, spring sealed up. 13, your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, henna with nard plants, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, along with all the finest spices. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water, and streams flowing from Lebanon. Okay, which, of course, is the only mountain high enough to get regular snow in all of Israel. Though Jerusalem sometimes gets snow, they recently had some. You know, it's relatively rare. And so, you know, the mountain streams coming down from this area are fresh and pure, and they're the lifeblood of the whole nation. By the way, the Jordan River, which flows from north to south the entire length of the country until it gets to the Dead Sea,
It is the single most important lifeline for all agriculture, all consumption by animals and humans as well. It is, you know, the reason there's an Israel and why it is so beautiful. Where does it originate? Foot of Mount Hermon. It bursts right out of the rock, you know, a subterranean fountain there that is, to this day, wondrously beautiful to behold.
So again, he's comparing her, you know, to this fresh water, this stream flowing from Lebanon. In verse 16, she responds, "Awake, O north wind, and come wind of the south. Make my garden breathe out fragrance. Let its spices be wafted abroad. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits." Solomon responds in the first part of verse 5, "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk." And the chorus says the last part of verse 1, "Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers." So that the wedding day scene begins with what?
Columns of smoke and the sedan chair of Solomon himself coming now to the wedding scene itself. He declares his love, what we would call vows today, at great length. It's the longest song in the whole of the book. She responds. They are joined in marriage. The chorus sings, "Happy for you," and that scene comes to an end.
As does this class. We covered 32 verses tonight. That's a lot. Okay? So, everything so far, save the little bit of the dream scene in verses 1 through 5, where she's kind of, you know, at a loss to find him, and she's unhappy because she can't find him, but it's just, you know, a manifestation of love. Everything so far in this has been really pretty positive, hasn't it? Okay? There's a real dark scene coming. Chapter 5, verse 2 through chapter 6, verse 3. So as you read ahead, now we're going to have a setting change, a scene change, and this time, you know, the music is really heavy, and the setting is dark, okay? And so now, after all this joy and light, you know, and hopeful happiness, you know, suddenly you're going to get that contrast, and the artful songwriter or play author, you know, would do, taking you through a whole range of emotions. But throughout all of this range of emotions, which will also be encompassing the entirety of their whole married life, what we're going to see is it all goes to one thing. Marriage can and should and ought to be absolutely wonderful at all times. Everything is designed just to say, marriage is just a wonderful thing. Okay? Now, as I said when we started this expedition, weird stuff for a Sunday night, isn't it? Okay? We had to clean the acid going on. We finished Proverbs a little while ago. Let's keep Solomon together. So, here is our Song of Solomon. Hardly material that would encourage someone to say, "I really need to become a Christian tonight." You know, hardly material that says, "Oh, I see I've been kind of lackadaisical about my service. I recognize I need to rise up. You know, I need to be more faithful. I need to be productive servant in the kingdom of my Lord." But if someone among us tonight is looking for help in any of those regards, and by all means we want to offer that invitation, if we can help in any way, let me know, please, as we now stand and sing.